If you want to turn to the book of Jeremiah, we're going to be beginning our study of that book tonight. Of course, the adult class studied this one just a few short months ago. We're not going to spend a whole lot of time on this book, but we want to, at any rate, it'll probably take us about 4 weeks to get through it. We're going to try to cover about 13 chapters a week. And 13 chapters a week will get us through in 4 weeks. Jeremiah is a very interesting prophet. He's referred to as the weeping prophet. He also wrote the book of Lamentations that is a book of basically weeping, sorrow, and him describing and lamenting all of the problems that Israel had. As we look at the book of Jeremiah, we have outlines available for those who are interested. If you want to pick one up afterwards, you can do that as well, if you want to take that home with you. We start in chapter 1, and the first 3 verses are basically just an introduction telling about Jeremiah and who he was and when he lived. And Jeremiah, of course, lived during the last days of the kingdom of Judah. He was there at the end. And he was there when the children of Israel, the last of the children of Israel, the children of Judah, were taken into captivity. Of course, the northern tribes had been gone for quite some time by that point. But we see him during the time of Josiah and then the time of Josiah's few descendants who reigned for short periods of time. And he's warning the people. Throughout the book of Jeremiah, he's warning them of the coming captivity. And like many of God's prophets, he was not heeded. Nobody listened. Nobody paid any attention. Nobody did the things that needed to be done to get things right, to correct the problems that they had. We have to realize, though, how radical some of the things that Jeremiah suggested to those people would have been. We're in the midst of a war at this time. Imagine, if you will, that you were a prophet, and God spoke to you and told you to tell the United States, the government, and all of the people, that if they wanted to be saved, they needed to surrender to the enemy. Can you imagine how well that would go over? And yet, that's exactly the kind of thing that Jeremiah told the leaders of the people of Israel. He told them that if they wanted to be spared, what they were going to have to do is give up. They were going to have to give up and be submissive to that alien nation that was trying to conquer them. And if they would do that, then God would protect them. Of course, they didn't do that. As a result of that, many of them died, and of course many others were carried off into captivity as a result of it. But they didn't get to stay in the land because of the fact that they were not submissive in that situation. But imagine, just imagine how well that kind of thinking would go over. That's just not the kind of thing that a nation does. That's not the kind of thing that the leadership of a country would do. We don't give up. We're going to fight to the last man. We're going to stand our ground. We're going to defend our country. And that's, of course, I'm sure, the same kind of thinking that the children of Israel had at that time as well. As we look at the book of Jeremiah, we begin this after he introduces himself and explains when and how he would prophesy. In verse 4, through verse 19, we see Jeremiah's call and his first vision. We're going to look at a few verses there, 4 through 8, to begin with. Then the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. And before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee, and I ordained thee a prophet unto the nations. That's a powerful couple of verses there. Before Jeremiah was even formed in the womb, God already knew him and had a purpose for his life. Of course, people people who are fond of abortion don't like to think about the things that the Bible has to say about it. They don't like to think about the fact that a person is a person before birth. They call it an embryo, they call it all sorts of other names, a fetus. But you know, the Bible says that a woman was with child. That embryo, or fetus as they call it, was already a child, even before birth. And that's the way God viewed it. He said, before I formed you, I knew you. And before you came out of the womb, I sanctified you. He already had a plan for Jeremiah's life. Life had already begun for Jeremiah. God already knew him at that time. And then he says in verse 6, Ah, Lord God, behold, I cannot speak, for I am a child. He said, I'm so young. But the Lord said unto me, Say not, I am a child, for thou shalt go to all that I shall send thee. And whatsoever I command thee, thou shalt speak. Be not afraid of their faces, for I am with thee to deliver thee, saith the Lord. We've got a few young people here tonight. You know, sometimes we take our youth as an excuse to not do what God says we need to do. Because we go, I'm just a child. That's for my parents, or that's for the older people at church. That's for the grown-ups to take care of. That's the kind of excuse Jeremiah gave. I'm just a child. God, don't send me on this mission. I'm just a child. And we don't know how old Jeremiah was when God first called him. He was young, but we don't know how young. And he says he was just a child. He was probably a young man. But he didn't feel confident to do what God said. But God told him, you go. You'll go where I tell you. You'll do what I tell you. You say what I tell you to say. And you don't need to be afraid because I'm going to be with you. You don't have to be afraid. I'm going to be with you. You know, often, and for those of you who are older, maybe you can remember when you were younger and when you were afraid sometimes. When you're afraid and you need some moral support, as we used to call it, you need somebody to encourage you, to stand there with you. Who better to take with you than God? God said, Jeremiah, I'm going to be with you. You don't have to worry about anything because I'm going to watch over you. I'm going to protect you. A lot of times, we might have looked up to an older friend or an older relative, maybe a brother or sister, or maybe even to our parents or somebody else that was, and we were safe as long as that person was with us. We weren't afraid anymore. Well, here's Jeremiah. God says, "Don't be afraid. I'll be with you." And then we look down to the end of the chapter. Verse 17, he tells Jeremiah again, Thou therefore gird up thy loins, and arise, and speak unto them all that I command thee. Be not dismayed at their faces, lest I confound thee before them. And then in verse 19 he says, And they shall fight against thee, but they shall not prevail against thee, for I am with thee, saith the Lord, to deliver thee. Now, oftentimes, we come up in the face of someone that unsettles us. Somebody that is intimidating. And God tells Jeremiah, don't be dismayed. Now, those people were going to give him some dirty looks. They were going to say some mean things, I'm sure. And they did some mean things as well. And God said, don't worry. I'm going to be with you. We know that God's with us. We should be able to do anything. Then at the beginning of chapter 2, we see that Israel forsaken God. And that's going to be the theme all the way through chapter 3 and verse 5. Israel forsaken God. In verse 5 of chapter 2, it says, Thus saith the Lord, What iniquity have your fathers found in me, that they are gone far from me, and have walked after vanity, and are become vain? God asks the question, if they found some fault in him. Well, we know the answer to that question is no. No, there's no fault in God. They didn't find fault in God, but instead they have gone far from Him. It wasn't Him that did the leaving. They did the leaving. And then in verse 13 he says, "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water." So something that won't hold water doesn't do you much good when you're thirsty. And yet that's what they had done. They had left Him as the living fountain, and they had gone to find something that could hold no water. Then in verses 26 and 27, he says, "As the thief is ashamed when he is found, so is the house of Israel ashamed. They, their kings, their princes, and their priests, and their prophets, say to a stock, or to a log, to a tree stump, 'You are my father,' and to a stone, 'Thou hast brought me forth.' For they have turned their back unto me, and not their face. But in the time of their trouble they will say, 'Arise and save us.'" Here they are. They've had this relationship with God for all these years, but then they turn away from Him to worship a tree trunk, to worship a rock. Just like Paul described in Romans chapter 1, they worship the created rather than the Creator. They miss the boat. Sounds a lot like our world today, doesn't it? A world where, in our society at least, so many worship some of them. And maybe that's maybe a little strong of a word. But they put such emphasis on the created things in this world. Why, if you're caught with an eagle feather, you can be arrested and thrown in jail. And if you were to kill an eagle, well, imagine what could happen to you. But people kill one another every day and get by with it. Which is more important, the eagle or the man that's created in God's image? We miss something somewhere. And we've got the scientists saying, we have descended from the earth, from the mud, from the slime, from the primeval ooze that they talk about. So they look to the earth and say, "You're our mother." How about Mother Earth? Now certainly God created the earth to provide many of the things that we need in a way like a mother would. But to think of the earth as a mother, to worship the earth, and there are some that do that as well. Think about this planet that God created. Oh, we came from it. God created us to inhabit it and to be over it. We have missed the boat so much, so many times. You have those people who chain themselves to a tree to keep it from being cut down, and yet they have missed the whole thing. But that tree, we need trees. Trees are good things. But they've missed the boat. They're obsessed with all of the wrong things. They've turned and wandered so far from God. They're so obsessed with nature and with the things of this world. They forget about God. And then in chapter 3, beginning in verse 6, we read about how Israel continued in their unfaithfulness. All the way through chapter 4 and verse 4. We look at verses 6 through 8. "The Lord also said unto me in the days of Josiah the king, 'Hast thou seen that which backsliding Israel has done? She has gone up upon every high mountain and under every green tree, and there hath played the harlot. And I said, after she had done all these things, turn thou unto me, but she returned not, and her treacherous sister Judah saw it. And I saw, when for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill of divorcement. Yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also.'" You know, there are a lot of ways that we can learn lessons in this life. The best way, the easiest way for us to learn lessons is to learn from somebody else's mistakes so we don't make the same one. But so many times, just like Judah, we're too hard-headed to learn from the mistakes that somebody else makes. We've got to go make the same mistake ourselves. Instead of looking and seeing what happened to all those people that traveled down that same path before, we think, it'll be different with me. I can do it. I'll be okay. I can drink and not become an alcoholic. I can do some drugs and never get addicted to them. I can gamble a little and I'll win and I won't lose like everybody else. I can do this or I can do that. I can tell a little lie and a little lie here and there and it won't ever be a problem. I'll be able to handle it. It doesn't work that way. It just doesn't work that way. And we see time and time again, we've seen other people try those things, and we've seen where they wound up. And then we want to try and turn around and do some of those same kinds of things. We need to learn from other people's mistakes. If Judah had seen what happened to Israel, realize that by the time Jeremiah is writing, Israel is already in captivity. They have been taken out of their land, taken into Assyrian captivity, and have been there for several years, even generations, by the time this is going on. And yet, does Judah realize, well, we're doing the same thing they did. We better stop doing this. No. They just keep on going right down that same path. And as a result of that, in a very short time after Jeremiah prophesied these things, they too are going to wind up in captivity. Then in chapter 4, beginning in verse 5, God begins to describe the destruction that's coming. It's coming from the north. Very interesting, because Hezekiah had the envoys from Babylon into his palace and had shown them everything. Oh, they were from a long way off, so it wasn't a big deal. That's a long way from here. We don't have to be afraid of them. We don't have to worry about them. We're going to make an alliance with them. Everything's going to be okay. And God sent Isaiah to tell Hezekiah what had happened because of the fact that he had shown them everything. That they're going to wind up having everything. Not during Hezekiah's lifetime, but in the lifetime of his descendants. And that certainly is the case here. The disaster from the north is coming. Verse 22 of chapter 4. You see, for my people is foolish. They have not known me. They are sottish children, and they have none understanding. They are wise to do evil, but to do good, they have no knowledge. You ever met somebody like that? You ever met somebody who, when it came to doing something, they shouldn't do something wicked, something evil? Well, they were good at it. They could figure out ways that, the way most criminals are. And they spent half as much time working a real, honest job as they did at being criminals. They could have made a lot of money. But instead, they put all of their energy and all of their time and all of their devotion into trying to be crooked. Into lying and cheating and stealing. And what's the result of that? Oh, well, they may gain some things for a short time in this life. But what's the end result? They don't know how to do this. They just don't know how. We've got a whole generation of young people coming up now that they would know, they don't even know the difference between good and bad. They've got it so confused because of the teaching that they've gotten from television and from their own parents and from their older brothers and sisters. They've gotten so confused that they think that good is bad and bad is good. They think it's good to cuss everybody out, hit and kick and bite and scream. And they think that's what they're supposed to do. Drink and smoke and do drugs and do all that. That's what we're supposed to do. They're so confused. A whole generation of children who have been brought up wise to do evil, but with no It's our job as a church to be the light of the world, to show people the way to do good, to show people what good is, and to show that it's a better choice. Chapter 5, then, beginning in verse 1, Jeremiah points out that there's not one that's upright, not one is righteous. He says in verse 1, "Run ye to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem, and see now, and know, and seek in the broad places thereof, if you can find a man, if there be any that executeth judgment, that seeketh the truth, and I will pardon it." God said if you can find one man in the whole city of Jerusalem that's a good man, that does execute judgment, that seeks the truth, I'll pardon the whole city. That's a better deal than Sodom and Gomorrah got. But you know what? Not long after Jeremiah wrote this, Jerusalem was taken into captivity. We're living in the same kinds of times today where there are so few that there are some towns where you can't find a good man or a good woman. Jeremiah could have depressed you. Now this echoes, though, what Paul says in the book of Romans. No one is righteous. No, not one. All have gone astray. None seek the Lord. And he goes on and on about it, too. Now the difference between Jeremiah's time and Paul's time was that between Jeremiah's time and Paul's time, Christ came. And now, we have hope. We have Jesus that we can depend on. Jeremiah, they didn't have that. It was dependent on whether they had done the right thing, and they had. God was going to punish them for it. Now that doesn't mean to say that since Jesus came, we don't have to worry about doing what's right. That's not the point at all, but how much better things are with Christ. And then chapter 6 deals with Jerusalem under siege. Now not that they were already under siege, but God's warning them. He's telling them what's fixing to happen. Just flat out telling them what's about to happen, and they're not listening. Now I think back to September 11th. Some people say that all the warning signs were there. Some people say that there were different people in different, some in the FBI, some in the CIA, some in the NSA, some of them that knew some of the things that were going on, and if they had put it all together, they could have prevented those things from happening. But they didn't put them all together. They didn't get the information to the right people to be able to stop it. But imagine, if you will, if they had been told, if there had been a warning so plain and so clear that said, look, at this particular time, on this particular day, these three different planes are going, this is what's going to happen exactly. Told them the flight numbers and all. You think they could have stopped it then? Yeah, they could have stopped it if they'd have known all of those details. Well, that's what God gives right here in Jeremiah. He tells them exactly what's going to happen, and they still can't stop. He tells them in verse 6, he said, "Oh, you children of Benjamin, gather yourselves to flee out of the midst of Jerusalem." He says, "You better get out of there. You better get out." In verse 6, he says, "For thus hath the Lord of hosts said, hew ye down trees." See, there's nothing wrong with cutting down trees. The Lord said it was okay. "And cast a mount against Jerusalem." That's a siege wall. They're gonna besiege the city. That's what he's saying. He's saying this to the Babylonian army. He's warning the children of Israel, though, that this is what he's saying. He's saying, cut down the trees and cast a mount against Jerusalem. This is the city to be visited. She is wholly oppressed in the midst of her. He said, go ahead. Get your army together and circle the city. Build up the walls around it. Block them in. And yet, even with that warning, the children of Israel did nothing to change what was coming. We go on then. The end of chapter 7, God begins a section where he talks about false religion being worse than, I'm sorry, the beginning of chapter 7, rather, God begins with false religion being worthless. Verses 9 through 11, notice what he says. He steal, murder, and commit adultery, and swear falsely, and burn incense unto Baal, and walk after other gods whom he know not. And then, notice what he, after they do all of those things, he says, and then come and stand before me in this house, talking about the temple, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered to do all these abominations. In other words, say it's okay that we did all those things because we're coming to worship God too. There are a lot of people that do that. It's okay we go out and do whatever we want during the week, and we come to church on Sunday, and that makes it alright, whatever else we do. He says, is this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, even I have seen it, saith the Lord. Exactly what you're doing. This is also a section of scripture quoted in the New Testament in reference to Jesus throwing the money changers out of the temple. Made my house a den of robbers and thieves. God's house. And look at the way they were treating it. And they thought it was okay that they worship all these false gods, but as long as they came and gave God his due, everything would be alright. We'll give him his 5 minutes and then we can get the other gods theirs. See, they missed the boat. God doesn't share. We talked about this morning. God's praise and honor and glory is for him and for him alone. He won't share. He doesn't take second place and he doesn't share first place. It's him and him alone or nothing. He won't take part. He demands all or nothing. To the end of chapter 7, in verse 30 begins the section about the valley of slaughter, where the children of Israel are going to suffer so badly that there'll be so many dead that they won't even be able to gather them up and bury them. There's going to be so many dead. They'll just have to leave them on the ground. And then in chapter 8, beginning in verse 4, all the way through the end of chapter 9, we see a section about how sin brings punishment. Every time. Now, sometimes people think they get away with it because there's no immediate consequence. But there is always a consequence. And there is always a punishment that is associated with sin. Well, people may get away with it in this lifetime. But there is a punishment. Sin always brings a punishment. And he talks about, in chapter 8, verses 11 and 12, verse 11, he says, for they have healed the hurt of the daughter of my people slightly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Were they ashamed when they had committed abomination? Nay, they were not at all ashamed, neither could they blush. Therefore shall they fall among them that fall. In the time of their visitation they shall be cast down, saith the Lord. One of the worst things to deal with someone who is in sin is when they just flat out deny that they've done it. You know, when someone admits that they've done wrong, and they admit they're sorry for that, and they want to do better, now you can deal with that. But when somebody is not even ashamed of what they've done, not embarrassed at all, he said, now they couldn't even blush. They so boldly went about to do their evil deeds that they didn't even blush about it. Nobody ashamed at all. And then there were these false prophets that were going around telling people, it's okay, we're at peace with God, there's no trouble, everything's okay. Sound like today. You know, you've got churches out there telling people it's okay to be homosexual and live in homosexual relationships. It's okay for you to be shacking up and you're not married. It's okay, all these, that's okay. You're at peace with God because God loves you. Where did they get that? They must be reading a different Bible than the one. Because God says, that's abomination, all of these things. And he said, these people weren't even ashamed. But these false prophets run around hollering, peace, peace. God says, there is no peace. How many people are behaving in that way? And then chapter 9 and verse 1, Jeremiah says, "Oh, that my head were water, that my eyes a fountain of tears, that I may weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people." You ever cry for the lost? You ever weep over those who've had the opportunity to obey the gospel and receive? You ever weep for those who knew the truth and were part of the church and left it like Jesus? Jeremiah says, "Oh, if my eyes were fountain of tears, I could weep day and night." Just keep crying for the sorrow over those who should have known better, but didn't do better. Then in chapter 10, verses 23 and 24, he says, "Thus saith the Lord, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches, but let him that glorieth glory in this." You wanna have something to glory about? It's not whether you're rich, it's not whether you've got some sort of great wisdom, it's not whether you've got some sort of power, you're a mighty person. He says, if you want to glory in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, saith the Lord. You want to glory in something? You better glory in the mercy and kindness of God. Because without that, you're nowhere in life. All of us. We can't glory in anything that we've done. Paul says, "I boast not, but in the cross." Where our boasting is. We boast about our own deeds. We're wasting our time. Our deeds are nothing. We want to boast about something. We're going to have to boast about Christ and his deeds. Chapter 10, broken up into three different sections, up to verse 16, God versus the idol. And 17 through 22, destruction is coming. And then the last three verses, verse 25, Jeremiah's prayer. We're going to look at a couple of verses from God versus idol section, verses 2 to 5. "Thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the heathen, and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven." Kind of a lot like astrology and the horoscopes that are in the newspaper, the signs of heaven. So don't be dismayed at that. "For the heathen are dismayed at them. For the customs of the people are vain. For one cutteth a tree out of the forest, the work of the hand of the workman, with the axe. They deck it with silver and with gold. They fasten it with nails and with hammers, that it moves not. They are upright as the palm tree, but speak not. They must needs be born, because they cannot go. Be not afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, neither also did them do good." Well, some people have tried to say that this is a condemnation of Christmas trees. I don't think God is real concerned about whether we hang pretty things in our house. What he's talking about here is these people that worship this tree. They go out there and they find a tree growing in the forest. They cut it down and then they decorate it up. Either they coat it with silver or gold or whatever, and take it home and they have to nail it up so it'll stand up, because it won't, without its roots, the tree can't stand up anyway. So they have to stand the thing up. It can't talk, it can't move, it can't do anything, and then they're afraid of it, and they honor it, and they reverence it, and they worship it. And we say, that's ridiculous. Who would do such a thing? Well, a lot of people in the United States do that with other things. They do that with a car, or a swimming pool, or a television set. They bring it in, they set it up, and they take that car, and they wash it and wax it and keep it pretty all the time, and they worship that thing. We don't do it with trees. We've grown beyond that. Now we do it with other things that we've made out of metal and rock and different minerals. But it's the same thing. We've got to learn from other people's mistakes. All these many years ago, yet people haven't changed that much. They still worship things that they can't move on their own, can't talk on their own, can't do anything good or evil. It's kind of amazing in our society. It seems like inanimate objects are becoming blamed for all sorts of things. They talk about, there's a car accident, and, somebody was driving an SUV. They'll say, the SUV did this and did that. The SUV didn't do it. The person driving it did, kind of remind you of the woman that ran over her husband two or three times with her car and then blamed the car for it. Well, these things don't do it. The old saying, guns don't kill people, people kill people. They just use the gun to do it. But if they didn't have a gun, they'd use something else. They'd use knives, they'd use clubs, I read about one case where somebody used a screwdriver. They do it with poison. People that are out to do things, they find ways. We can't blame the objects that they use. Then we come to chapter 11. Chapter 11, the first 17 verses, talks about the covenant being broken, and then the last few verses about how the plot is beginning to grow against Jeremiah. The leaders of the people are ready to get rid of him. In verse 7, he says, "For I earnestly protested unto you, your fathers, in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt, even unto this day, rising early and protesting, saying, Obey my voice. Yet they obeyed not, nor inclined their ear, but walked every one in the imagination of their evil heart. Therefore I will bring upon them all the words of this covenant, which I commanded them to do, but they did them not." Isn't that the warning? The Lord's a jealous God. If you say you're going to keep His law, you better keep it, because if you don't, He's going to get you. And yet they say, "Oh no, we're going to keep. We'll keep it. We'll follow the Lord." All the way from Moses on, they warned them, "You better be faithful. You better follow it." But instead, they broke the covenant. Because of that, God said, "I'm going to bring everything on." Now, He gave the blessings and the curses. The blessings that they obeyed and the curses that they disobeyed. Now He's bringing those curses on them because they disobeyed. Chapter 12. In the first four verses, Jeremiah complains. Verse 1. He says, "Righteous art thou, O Lord, when I plead with thee. Yet let me talk with thee of thy judgment. Wherefore does the way of the wicked prosper? Wherefore are all they happy that deal very treacherously?" Why are the wicked prospering? Why are those people that are so treacherous, why are they happy? And here I am, I'm miserable. Everybody's out to get me, and I'm trying to do right, and they're all doing wicked, and they're getting along fine. He says, "Lord, why is that? That doesn't seem very just." And so God answers him then, beginning in verse 5. We're going to look at verse 17. He talks about how He's going to give them a chance to respond, to come back to Him. But He says in verse 17, "But if they will not obey, I will utterly pluck up and destroy that nation," says the Lord. So He tells Jeremiah, just wait. Just be patient. God takes care of things in His own time. He doesn't do it on our time frame. Just because we think somebody's done bad and ought to be punished right now, doesn't mean God's going to do it right now. He's going to do it in the fullness of His own time. And then chapter 13, we have several different things going on in this chapter. The linen girdle object and lesson. And we talked about that one in our adult class, how he had to take that linen garment and bury it in the ground, and it got all nasty and yucky. And then they would say it was yucky. And then he had to wear it. And he said, that's how it was with God, being with these filthy, rotten people, the Israelites, that He had loved them, but they were rotten. And then He talks about the wineskins and how He was going to just fill them up and smash them with their drunkenness and their wine. And then in verse 15, He starts talking about the threat of captivity that's coming toward them. And in verse 17, He says this, "But if you will not hear it, my soul shall weep in secret places for your pride, and mine eyes shall weep sore and run down with tears, because the Lord's flock is carried away captive." God's given them every chance. Time and time and time again, He's given them chance after chance after chance. And now he's saying, this is it. Last chance. And you know, God doesn't give us that many chances. He doesn't tell us of those chances. But we don't know when our last chance is. It might be tonight. It might be tomorrow. For some, that last chance has already passed. And there won't be another. For some, that were, even perhaps that we're here this morning, that was their last chance. We don't know. But we do know that there will come a last chance. We need to take advantage of the first chance that we get, so we don't have to worry about the last chance. If you're here tonight, you have need to respond to the invitation for any reason. We ask that you do so as we stand.